Welcome to the AquariumMax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 175, recorded August 26th, 2013.
Greetings, AquariumMaxers everywhere.
Hello, hello. I am back. I can hear you all saying, yay! I'm just kidding.
Oh, you shouldn't be kidding.
No. But, oh, I have a language today.
Yes, you do.
Okay, because I just got back from Texas, right? Mm-hmm. So, howdy, y'all.
There you go. So, any Texans out there, please critique her accent, intonation, voice
yes,
quality settings.
Yes, please.
So on.
Okay. Actually, I don't mean that in a silly way. I really liked Texas, the little bit of it that I saw. Everybody was very friendly.
Yep, I like
they
Texas,
nice.
Too. Every time I've gone there, I've enjoyed it.
And we saw anoles.
And koi.
And koi.
Lovely
wild plants. Feral koi. No, they were in a pond. And a cardinal.
Yeah.
And what else did I see? Did I see anything else?
Cardinal tetra.
Lots of dancers.
Or the bird.
Those weren't feral either, though. They were.
That's good.
You know, mostly human.
Okay. Well, what's
one
our lineup for
like
today?
Like a bird.
Yeah, you kind of did. Huh?
No, I didn't. One of the dancers.
Oh.
The guy dancers.
Oh,
okay. Anyways, you're like, okay, I don't know what my wife is talking about.
Okay, I'm getting a little confused.
Okay, let's talk about fish.
Okay.
We have Mick in Carnforth, and Tom in Provo, and Matt in Perth, in Australia, and Bob in Boston, and Pete from on the website. It's Cyber Pete.
Okay.
Okay, so we'll do Mick first, or do
yes.
you have something that you want to tell us first?
Oh, well, yeah, we kind of missed last week because Kelly had just gotten back. And
we were very tired.
So, yeah, but we're back now.
Yes.
So you probably noticed that.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So
okay.
We apologize for the lapse.
Yes, but we're back and running
yes.
now.
Okay. So Mick says, must be great having the Aquara kids to do stand-in when Kelly is missing. Okay, I didn't even know that Russ had done that, and we were just setting up just like a few minutes ago to do this recording. And I pulled up the last one, and I hear Gwen talking in her little fish about sword tails and guppies and... I died. It was so cute. It made me laugh. It was very funny. Okay. So, yes, it's great.
It is. I'm glad they participated.
Mm-hmm. He says, saw the YouTube video of the geckos. Very cool. It made me wonder if other aquarmaxers out there have herpy tendencies, too.
It's kind of a dangerous phrase there, but yeah. Yeah, actually, several people have been interested in that, and we'll talk a little bit more about that a little later. Yeah.
Great. He says, great overview of making up the planted bioactive vivarium. I use a very similar setup for my crested gecko and Pac-Man frog.
That's cool. I think crested geckos are very dinosaurian and interesting reptiles.
Yes.
Yep.
That's true.
Okay.
Alrighty, Tom.
So thanks for that, Mick. I'm glad there are people out there who appreciate the herpetological side of Aquarimax when it peeks through.
Why don't you read Tom's?
I'm going to read Tom?
Yeah.
Okay,
I'll
read Tom.
Just to mix things up and keep it fresh.
Okay, this is Tom in Provo, Utah. It says, Russ, Kelly, and Aquarimaxers everywhere. How could Kelly's role in the show be any clearer? She is the listener advocate who asks Russ for the clarifications that listeners would ask for if they were there. Absolutely indispensable. And she brightens up the podcast greatly. I agree on both points.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It's nice to know that I am useful. That's like all official sounding listener advocate.
Yeah,
I could hang a shingle outside my door.
Well, I agree on both points, and I think it's great that Tom's recognized that.
Yes,
so.
That's very nice of you. Thank you.
And I missed having you there, as fun as it was to have the girls join us last week. Okay, so where are we now? Oh,
he says he enjoyed the morning gecko video, and they're very interesting little creatures.
Yep, so see, there's another one who is interested in reptiles and amphibians. There you go.
He says, I hope you will provide an update on the pygmy quarries. Could you also provide some guidelines for keeping quarries in general? I have been less than successful with them, by which I mean they all died. I will not add any more until I am confident I have an environment in which they can be healthy. The pH is about 8, and I don't think I was patient enough acclimating the quarries before adding them to the tank. Or is a pH of 8 beyond the limits of what quarries can reasonably be expected to adjust to? Other citizens of the tank are doing well.
Okay. Let's address this before we go further on, I think. No, actually, let him read his other part, because
okay. Well, that's I can't let him read the other part. He's not here.
I mean,
we'll
have you read
by proxy. Yeah. Read.
Okay.
For him. Yeah. Okay. This raises a related question about pH. I could get a lower pH by a series of small daily water changes to partially replace the tap water with RO water. But from that point on, can I remove 50% of the water and then add tap water to bring the tank to 75%, followed by RO water to bring the level to the top? Or do I need to mix the tap and RO water before adding them to the tank? Perhaps I'm either unduly or overly concerned about the fish being briefly exposed to a different pH.
Okay. So, let's talk about all this stuff.
Okay.
First, update on the pygmy quarries. Okay. Well, they seem to be doing fine. I have not found any fry in the tank yet. I still rather suspect that having the African dwarf frog in there is probably putting a damper on that to some extent. But...
Oh, we heard singing.
Oh, yeah, we did hear our African dwarf frog singing. That was kind of fun. Anyway, they're all doing pretty well. I am feeding them mostly the Hikari sinking wafers and Walter worms, and I'm using a plastic tube to target feed them, basically onto a terracotta plate, so that the food lands right on there and it doesn't fall into the gravel. It's especially significant with the Walter worms, but it's also important in terms of the wafers, which would fall apart and be eaten by the amphipods. So, because the amphipods are still in there, I haven't taken the frog out, even though they're greatly reduced. That's kind of the problem with the quarries right now. Probably part of the reason I'm not getting any spawns so far. I mean, they are a little young, most of them. The ones I had before I bought the extras are plenty old enough, but the others are a little young still. But they're probably getting to the point where they could easily spawn. So we'll see what happens. But it's fun to watch them schooling, especially right after I do a water change. They tend to get really active, and that's often when they spawn. I haven't seen that yet, but I have seen them get really active, and especially also in the mornings when the light first turns on, they'll school around the tank, and it's fun to see. Now, in terms of keeping quarries in general, I have kept a few species of quarries, mostly Corydoras aeneas, the bronze quarry, although many of the ones that I've kept have been the albino form. Also kept, Corydoras punctatus, and of course Corydoras pygmaeus. Probably a couple others over the years, mm-hmm. but those are the ones that I've done the most of the time. In terms of keeping quarries in general, I would say research the particular species to find out more about the temperature and water conditions. Some are more picky than others. The aeneas are not very picky at all. In terms of the pH that you mentioned, the pH of 8, I don't think that is a problem as long as they're acclimated to it. I've had fish, quarries spawn in that water. I don't think it's a problem. In pH of 8, right in your area where you live, in Orem, and they were spawning in that, and so I don't think that's an issue at all. As long as they're acclimated. If you take some fish that are, you know, wild caught and they're used to their water that with a lower pH, and you put them right in, that could be an issue, of course. So I don't think that's much of an issue. I think in terms of, let's see, we talked about temperature, talked a little bit about pH, but as long as I would recommend actually keeping aeneas probably first before you keep any other quarries. They're one of the most adaptable. They've been extensively bred in captivity, and you might even find some that are bred in the local water if you go to the pet store and pick some up. A lot of them come in from people who have bred them, so that would be a good way to do it. Let's see, in terms of food, they love worms of all sorts, and they really do need a lot more food than most people give them credit for, and they need high-quality food. So it's good to feed them sinking wafers and frozen food and worms, you know, grindle worms, bloodworms are good, even though they're not true worms. Things like that, after the lights have gone out, so that they have a chance. You know, or feed the top fish something they're really excited about. The fish that tend to feed from the top, feed them something they're really excited about, and then drop a few things in corners for the quarries. You know, make sure they get enough food.
Do it when the lights are already off?
That's a good way to do it, yeah.
Feed the top fish when the lights are off?
No, but feed the other fish before the lights go off, and then just when the lights go off, then feed the quarries.
Then put the stack in.
Yeah. That's a good thing to do. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. Those are general sorts of things. They ought to do fairly well if those things are followed and, you know, they're properly acclimated to the water and you've got you know, they've been quarantined and all that. But I wouldn't recommend getting some of the more exotic species right away. You know, make sure you get something that's more acclimated to the water. I've noticed the albino corys, a lot of albino species in general, albino morphs of species in general are often weaker, but the albino corys seem to be pretty tough little guys. So if you may not want albinos, you can just go for the bronzes. They're kind of nice looking.
I'm not a big albino.
I generally prefer non-albino things, generally, so anyway. But I don't mind the albino corys for whatever reason. I like them fine. Okay. So, let's talk about the question of the pH, whether you should take 50% of the water out of a tank that is already partway RO and part tap water, and then add some tap water, and then add RO water, or you should mix them first. I would mix them first, a couple reasons for that. One is the buffering capacity of the tap water. You know, you have that to contend with, and it can cause pH changes over a matter of a number of hours after it is in other water. You know, the pH can be high for a while and then drop, and that's not good. So I would mix them outside. If you have a large bin that you can aerate, you could put half RO water and half tap water in there and let it percolate for 24 hours, you know, with an air stone or a small pump and a heater, and get it all ready. That would be my preference. Because fish being briefly exposed to a different pH can be an issue if it's too much of a difference, and it doesn't have to be much to be too much.
It's okay to be picky and careful.
Yeah, it's better to be careful than not worry about it too much. It's something I would consider important. And hey, maybe your wife listening to this will let you set up the 75-gallon tank. You know, who knows?
Does it say 75-gallon?
75-gallon tanks, yeah, or more.
Oh yeah.
More.
Oh yeah, he says she was particularly fond of the corys and wishes we had more.
Yeah.
He says, could you write a letter assuring her that the only way we can keep corys is if I set up a new tank of 75 gallons for
Oh, I forgot that I hadn't read that yet. Yeah.
That's funny.
But he said, I guess I should not joke. She's actually very supportive of my participation in the hobby.
That's good.
That is good.
Fishy wives.
Yes.
That's us.
Yep, Kelly's supportive of me too, as you probably noticed by now. So the fish is with him, and may the fish continue to be with him. I hope it all works out, and I hope we get some more corys.
That would be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty.
Should we talk about... Go ahead.
No.
Matt.
Matt, yes.
Perth, Western
that's
Australia.
What I was
going to say. Mm-hmm.
Yes, let's go to Australia.
Okay.
Alrighty, he says, this week's questions. I am currently keeping a 4-inch koi and 2-inch fancy goldfish in a 14.8 US gallon aquarium as a temporary housing until their new deluxe pond is installed in the backyard. The tank has no light, a bubble stone in it, and an aqua clear 70 as the filtration. How long do you think I can keep them in this environment? With the overkill and filtration, I am hoping at least 2 months. Do I need to do more regular water changes than a normal setup? Sadly, Mr. Koi gets scared when I go by the tank, which makes water changes unpleasant for both of us. On the subject of ponds, do you think it would be possible to have a marine pond? I'm not keen to start one, but it would be an interesting, expensive experiment.
Expensive is right. Okay, well, let's look. I would say 14.8 gallons is not very much. So if you look at it as very temporary housing, I suppose it might be okay. But yes, I would step up the water changes. I'd probably do, if you have the ability to do so, probably 40 to 50% water changes every other day or more. You have to really, really do it a lot with. Because koi are, you know, big fish. A 4-inch koi is still a pretty hefty fish. That's a lot of fish in that there. And then you have the two fancy goldfish, which are also heavy bodied.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of pushing it. But if it's a couple of months, then you're doing heavy water changes with good, healthy, happy water for them. Very often, I would do a lot of water changes.
It's exciting he's going to have a pond out there.
It is exciting, yeah. I hope it goes well. Unfortunately, it sounds like the koi is having problems, but I would expect that after getting used to you a little bit more and getting used to the fact that you're the one bringing the food, the koi should calm down.
Do they have anything to hide in when they're feeling stressed?
And that's a good point, something I was thinking about too. Do you have a little bit of plant cover in there? Or, you know, even fake plant cover, anything like that? That would help him feel a little bit more comfortable? That might help.
He needs a security blanket.
Yeah, that might help. But I think, honestly, it's pushing it in a tank that small, but if you just keep the water changes and, you know, you want to make sure the temperature is good and the water quality and pH are all pretty similar to what you already got, but I would do heavy water changes or something like that. I mean, you know, ideally what I do on this 37-gallon tank we have with just two fancy goldfish and that's it. Well, I guess we've got a couple of little things in there, but no big fish, just a little placo, little small bristlenose placo and an olive nerite and a shrimp in there along with them. But I do 50% water changes twice a week on that, and
so
that's 37 gallons.
Like every day or every other day?
And so he's got more fish in a smaller tank and probably more bio load in a smaller tank, so I would do quite a bit more than that.
Like every day?
Every day would be great if you have, you know, you can do that and keep everybody happy in terms of, you know, have to make sure the water quality is not going to shock them.
But right.
If you can do that, then yeah, I would do that. That would help. And then they'd also grow a lot faster and be ready for your pond. In the terms of marine ponds, yes, it is possible. I've read about it. I know people do it. I'm sure it would be ridiculously expensive. But
it would be a lot of salt to make salt.
Yeah. I mean, it depends on where you are. If you lived in a place where you could filter and pump out ocean water into it and have it flow back or something through another filter so you're not contaminating the ocean with things. But if you could do a flow-through, like, remember Dave in...
Baby?
Yeah, in Hawaii. He was working in a couple of those aquaculture facilities where they had flow-throughs.
Yeah, that's true. They had the sharks in there, didn't they?
Well, yeah, the sharks were in the flow-through and they had... He said he had... Remember the freshwater facility?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's sort of not applicable, but he had that... That was on flow-through until he converted it. But he had all his feather dusters on flow-through.
It wasn't very close to the beach, though.
No, but he did. He did have it on flow-through.
They had it piped in?
Well, the freshwater one, it didn't matter. It didn't need to be close to the beach because it was freshwater.
Oh,
so, but, he had all of his feather dusters that he was doing his research with on flow-through.
That's all true. I remember because it was right out the door.
Yeah, and Coconut Island. It was right there.
That was pretty neat.
So you can do marine ponds. And we saw several there in Coconut Island that were done, but I'm sure that what Matt's talking about is non-flow-through, but I have read about those too. It's been a while. I was trying in vain to find this article that I had read about. The first article I ever read when I was a kid, actually, about doing a marine pond, and it was so old, because it was back like in the early 80s when I read it, I thought that might be of interest to us just from a historical standpoint to see that people had succeeded at making a saltwater pond, just a backyard pond. I think they lived in Florida. That was saltwater.
Wow.
And it was working.
That's kind of amazing.
And it had windows in it, too.
So it was different levels so you could look in.
One of the walls was a window.
I would love to have a pond
with
like that.
You know, special glass, of course, thick glass, mm-hmm. and that they had built into the ground so that people could walk down under this little roof thing and look into the pond from the side.
That would be neat.
Yeah. It was very cool, but like I said, I read about it when I was like 9, and now I can't remember where I read it.
It's probably not really available anymore.
No, I couldn't find it, but anyway, so it does happen. If any of you have had saltwater ponds, please tell us about it.
That would be very interesting.
Okay.
I think we should take our break.
Okay, let's do it. Okay, so, one thing I should say is that Matt asked me about the... There's a strong stereo separation in the show. In other words, you come out one headphone and I come out of the other.
Because we're surround.
And we're going to talk about that so that we can fix that. So that if you're just listening with one headphone.
Well, isn't it because we have two different microphones?
Right, but it's easy enough. I mean, it's possible. I don't know how to do it yet, but I'll investigate. And I think Matt can help me with that, how to fix it. So apparently it's not that hard to do post-production.
Okay.
You fix it, so...
Very good.
So thanks, Matt.
Alrighty, Bob in Boston.
Oh, I want to say something that he wanted to say, and I'm just going to paraphrase this part because I can't tell all of it because some of it's a secret. But we may have another show soon related to stingrays.
Oh, that would be neat.
Yeah, but we'll see how that goes. It'll be fun. I hope it works out, but I will spare you the details in case it doesn't happen, or to just to whet your appetite in case it does. I hope it does.
Okay, yeah, that would be exciting. Alrighty, so he's talking about, he got 10 juvenile Altum angels last week. This is a very beautiful Rio Atabapos?
I'm not sure where the accent... I don't sure where the accent falls there.
Atatapos.
Okay.
I don't know. Atabapos.
Mm-hmm.
That's the river they're from? Or is that a color variety?
Well,
or what?
Hue or Rio, depending on which language, does mean river, so probably.
Assuming that's where it's from. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Amazonas Magazine describes three varieties from three different rivers. Of course, they're all beautiful, but the Atabapos are what you think of when you imagine Altums. Very tall, brown stripes, and not shy. I dug a quickie 500-gallon pond. I love that. I really fast dug 500-gallon pond. No sweat.
Maybe he has a backhoe.
Yeah. Lined it and threw in rainwater from my barrels. I also discovered where my mycobacteria is coming from. The barrels! Mm. Oh, that's very sad. 7 dead fish later, I have 3 magnificent survivors outside in a 30-gallon tank with an old 9-watt tetrapond. UV working on the side. Thank you, Diana Wallstead and Aquarimax.
Well, I'm glad you had some survivors. I'm sorry about the 7
that's
you lost.
That's a hard way to find out where it's coming from.
Well, there's something that's puzzling me, too, is that mycobacterium, the mycobacteria, the various species thereof that are problematic, don't tend to grow very fast. And so they don't tend to grow very fast within fish either. At least not at first. And so I'm wondering if he only had them for a week, if it is actually the mycobacteria that causes the problem. I'm wondering.
Well, maybe they already had it.
I'm curious.
It's just kicking up.
That's possible. I have noticed that once the fish have been infected for a long time, they can look pretty good for a while and then very quickly succumb to it. And I mean, I've never had any of them officially diagnosed. But I think it's something to consider that perhaps something else happened. But maybe you can furnish some more information to us as to your hypothesis why you believe it was the mycobacteria in the barrels. It may well be an agent in the barrels, and it might be mycobacterium. But I'm just wondering more about that, because the only thing that doesn't add up to me is that if you had them for only a week and they succumb to mycobacterium, it would seem hard for them not to be infected that quickly, because that's possible, but hard for them to get to the point where they're infected until it kills them in a week. So that's my only question there.
He's talking about the tank right now, I think. He's got them in. He says ice cubes keep the water at about 87 degrees during the day, and a heater does the same at night. It's only got about 20 gallons of water in it. This way I can turn it over 5 times, or 100 gallons per hour, and apply a single watt of UV light per 10 gallons. Overkill, maybe, but I'm taking no chances.
That's good. That's sensible.
Mm-hmm. The Altum's favorite food is insect larvae and baby brine shrimp. They also eat Daphnia, but won't gorge on it. They're still too small for larger black worms and baby guppies. They don't mind the ground like discus, but find a current to swim against and snap at passing food. At night, they abandon this activity and patrol the tank with as little as a full moon to light the way. These fish are real hunters. Their snout, large lean bodies, and nocturnal behavior tell me that they're not Scalaris.
Yeah, which is the chief ancestor of the angelfish that we see in pet stores.
Oh, okay. I'm starting to purchase a lot of UV equipment on eBay. I'll take care of my other tanks and hopefully find enough bargains over the winter to give the Altums their own rainwater pond next year. Jim Carmark says they're unlikely to breed in anything under 400 gallons, so hopefully an outdoor summer vacation will do the trick someday. It would be great to observe them in a semi-wild environment. I remember as a kid being fascinated by a pair of Oscars that patrolled my 10,000-gallon pond.
Can you believe that? That's so cool.
That's cool. Says he partially filled in our abandoned in-ground swimming pool.
I've always wanted to do that ever since I saw a documentary on that when I was a kid. Never had an in-ground swimming pool, though. But
let alone an abandoned one.
Right.
One would disturb the shoreline while the other stayed back to snap up the fleeing baby goldfish. I was impressed with their cooperation and patience, often swimming for days with little or no reward. Incredibly, they thrive.
Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing.
Cooperative hunting? And I mean, if you're going to think of fish capable of it, then cichlids make sense. But yeah. It's just cool that he was able to observe it, something he wouldn't observe typically in a tank.
In a fish tank.
Right.
There's no need for it in a fish tank.
And there's the topography of a tank doesn't even permit it, really. So, mm-hmm. Interesting.
It's pretty cool. It says, I enjoyed hearing from your girls last week and look forward to your next podcast. And P.S., I'm buying different types of UV modules. The ones used to make well water potable seem to be more solidly constructed and effective than the overpriced pet industry models. I steer clear of UVs made in China.
That is a really nice tip. I'm going to check that out.
That is really
for the
good.
Well models of UV.
That's very cool.
Sterilizers or clarifiers. Yeah, that's a good idea. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Last one. Cyber Pete.
Wow. We're kind of burning through them today, aren't we?
Pete says, I set up my tank a year ago with no interest in plants. It is filtered with two hang-on-the-backs and has a gravel bottom. Now I want to get plants and a current LED light, but how do I change gravel for plant media? Also, where can I find information on the gecko vivarium you set up?
Okay. Does he say anything else?
He says, the podcasts are great. I love listening to them.
Okay, I can see there's something over there.
Yeah, I kind of left my inflection hanging, didn't I?
Okay. Let's see. So he wants to know first about the gravel for the plant media to change it. Well, first of all, let's say, depends on how far you want to go with plants and what kinds of plants you want to get. There are a lot of plants you could get that have absolutely no need for you to add plant specific media to the gravel. Yeah, I mean, and it depends on how fancy you want to get and what type of fertilization regimen, if any, you want to do in the water column. For example, you could put Java moss, Java fern, Anubias, and some of the hardier stem plants that are good at leaf feeding into a tank like that without having to touch the substrate, most likely. But let's assume you really want to go all out and you want to get a really nice substrate for your plants like Eco Complete or Fluorite, you know, something like that. There are others out there too. You want to do that. Now, the easiest way, without taking the tank down, is to use a Python or a gravel washer and get the gravel fairly clean by, you know, rinsing it out. And you might even want to get one of the recirculating gravel washers, which will take the gunk out of the tank and put the water back in so that you can clean the gravel thoroughly without having to worry about doing a 90% water change. You know? You might want to consider that, although that's kind of expensive. To buy one just for doing that. But let's assume that you've cleaned the gravel out already with a gravel washer and or a Python. So it's fairly clean. Now, the best thing is to get a deep square-sided container, like a water pitcher, something like that, that's square-sided on the front, and you have a handle on it. And having cleansed your hands, I like to use, you know, a paste of baking soda to scrub my hands and my arms up to the elbows and even past the elbows, rinse them off thoroughly, so I'm not going to introduce any soap, lotions, sweat. It reduces body oils, it does all those things. So you get those really clean, and then you push the flat-sided water pitcher down, and with your hands you kind of gently scoop the gravel in, and you can get most of it and pull it out. You can add plant media in there if there's a little bit of gravel at the bottom. It doesn't have to be pristine, completely empty. Right. And most likely, unless you've really thoroughly cleaned it, there's going to be some detritus in there. You're going to kick up into the water column. Your filter's going to, you know, it's going to get a lot of it. A lot of it's going to remain in the water column, make the water really mucky looking for a while. That's okay. It usually doesn't hurt the fish a bit. Depends on what you've got, I guess, but... In general, it doesn't usually hurt the fish to do that for a short time if you've got healthy biological filtration. So, you get most of the gravel out, and then you add the... Let's say you're going to add fluorite. This is what I recommend you
this
do.
This is all still with the water, mostly still
in. Yeah, most of the water, or all the water, is in the tank. You can't have all of it in there if you're reaching your hands in... Well, it depends on how deep your tank is, but, you know, you probably want to have it down a little bit, an inch
just
or so.
For displacement.
Yeah, and when you take the gravel out, it's going to go down more, right? So it'll be several inches down by the time you got the gravel out of there. Okay. Then, if you get a bag of fluorite, let's say, and make sure you get enough to fit the dimensions of your tank. I don't know what size your tank is, but let's assume you have one bag of fluorite in there. this is what I would recommend doing. You set the bag on the bottom of the tank. But this is, well, you have to rinse it first.
We have to rinse the fluoride?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. there are different methods for doing it. I believe the package recommends that you rinse it. Some people put it in dry, and then when you put it in dry, it sort of sucks its own dust up into its pores, kind of. It's kind of a weird sort of thing. To some degree, it'll do that. But you can also put it, you can rinse it out by, like, putting a hole in the top of the bag and shoving a hose into it outside and letting the hose run in there in the bag, and but not on a high, you know, not on a high pressure.
So it's not pushing the fluoride out.
Right, but it's dripping water out, and you just let it run in there until it runs clear, okay. And that'll rinse a lot of the fine dust out. But that fine dust is actually good stuff because it has a high surface area, and so the minerals are likely to go out into the water the way you want them.
So it's good for the plants.
Yeah, so there are things about that that
maybe
you don't really want to do.
Maybe it just makes a mess.
But it does make a mess. I mean, it'll make your tank really cloudy for a while. But like I said, it's usually not detrimental at all to the fish. I've done it many times without causing any harm. I've never had any deaths attributable to that gunk in the water. And it clears after a day or two.
Okay.
But then I would recommend, once you've done that or not, depending on your preference, setting the bag on the bottom of the tank and slicing it in a U shape, kind of a three-sided rectangle, along the sides of the bag.
Uh-huh.
Not at the top, right along the sides
so
of the bag.
Making like a flap.
Making a big flap. And then
it's
you just sort of...
kind of like the tear-out part on a Kleenex box.
Kind of, yeah. A big U-shape. And then you just pull on it, and the fluorite will just sort of fall into place, and then you lift up this empty bag that's sort of... Now it's two flaps.
Right.
You know, two flaps left. I hope that makes sense. Anyway, and you just kind of pull it out. And if you have to add more bags, you can do them the same way. And that will minimize the mess. If you try to put it by handful, or you try to do it, you know, dump it in like a flour into a sack, you know, it's going to make more of a mess. So that's a good way to do it.
So after you have them in however many bags you're going to put in, do you kind of smooth it down? Because it seems like it would still be sort of in a pile, at least somewhat.
It actually kind of... If you do it that way, just the way I'm describing it, it'll smooth out fairly well.
Maybe you should make a video on that.
Maybe I should. But you do need to, you probably need to move it a little bit. Usually like to slope it so that it's a little higher towards the back and lower towards the front, because it looks better. You can put more plants in the back, and it's good. But you don't have to do that. You can. I mean, that's what a lot of people do. So, that's a little bit of information. I hope that helps.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, if you're interested in doing plants and you want to start out small, I would not recommend messing with the gravel at all and just getting some of the simpler plants that don't really need anything like that. Because Java fern, Java moss, Anubias, they don't really go in the gravel that much. They send little rootlets into it, but you don't plant their rhizomes in the gravel anyway. You just set them on top or attach them to driftwood or whatever. And then you can see how you like doing easy plants. And then if you like them and they do well for you, then you know, move on and maybe switch your substrate out. All right, and you also had the question about the vivarium. I'm going to put a link to a website or two. One of the ones that helped me a lot was New England Herpeticulture. I purchased a lot of the materials for my vivarium at that website, and they have some great stuff, including tutorials on how to make vivariums from A to Z, the beginning to the end. They have everything for you in terms of explanations and materials. They've got it all. So hopefully that'll help. And... I think that's about all for this week.
I think that's everything.
So,
may the fish
be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comment and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.